Bible, there's nothing spiritual about it. And you could use it valuably in the sense of you wanted to contact some information in a library at a distance. Yes, you could make a legitimate use of it. That would be of value. But in general, there's no need of it. However, well, one of the books of, most recent books of Dr. Lilly, I think it was that dyad one. Have you seen, read that?
Yes, I have. The dyadic cycle one. Yeah. Read parts of it.
Where, he was lying in one of those sensory deprivation tanks.
Right.
You know, in salt water. In the water. And he saw some naked people running around there. And a woman came over to, who was curious about this tank, looked in at me, wait a minute, remember the incident. Well, that fits that astral plane that Monroe is talking about.
Mm. Yeah, Lilly talks a lot about experiences in the Samadhi tank, the sensory deprivation tank, where he's gone out and seemingly contacted other beings who were real at that level that he contacted them, that kind of...
Well, he's done a lot of experimenting. He also had some very narrow escapes.
What interests me in it is this this possibility that you've spoken of when a person who dies, who passes out of the body, who's attained realization, actually doesn't die, doesn't, and can remain in a subtle body on another plane. And I'm just really interested in that. I'm interested in your experience of that, or if, in fact, is it something that you feel you're going to do?
Well, of course, these reports from, not Monroe, what's his other name, on Life After Life, Moody's reports, are of an ordinary experience. They're supposed to be the death that everybody goes through naturally. What could happen in the case of an adept is another matter. There isn't much given on that in the Mahatma letters either. Just hints. But the ordinary person, according to the statement in Mahatma letters, doesn't know that he's dead when he dies. If he doesn't know, he's an adept or a sorcerer. That means it's something different. Correct. Than the ordinary process of dying.
It seems to indicate that the adept can pass, forego the necessities of the Kamaloka and Devachana. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zinya told me that there is a plane which is called the adept world. It's a subtle physical plane, but not visible from this, but very close to this. And that they deal with world problems from that plane. Only part of the time and only part of them ever out here in physical incarnation. Some of them are. There always are some. But more of them are functioning on that level.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of something I wanted to ask you about Devachan. Since Devachan is a subjective state,
yeah.
And nirvana would appear to be the same thing.
More subjective.
More subjective. My question is whether or not Devachan, in a sense, is a determinate subjective state, since it's a...
No, not permanent.
Determinate.
Oh.
Determinate subjective state, or a determinate nirvana, in a sense. Because it's it seems to be indicated as a world of effects.
Effects, right. Okay. By the effects of the karma set up during life.
Right.
And if one is set up a substantial amount of good causes, but that have some degree of lasting value, not the cause of
eating an ordinary meal.
In fact, you an ordinary meal, if there's just ordinary conversation, that probably wouldn't be carried in the air. But if during that meal there were some very serious things taken up in conversation that were about, well, the meal might be remembered then along with them. See, there is a point of separation of the darker, muddier side of the nature and the trivial. There's not necessarily muddy, but just trivial. Stuff that makes up a good deal of chit-chat talk, for instance. That is slept off, doesn't go to dink. But any of your serious efforts, where you've so included here, the effects would be retarded. And in general, you cannot forego that, because that's a necessary part of the whole experience.
Period
of assimilation. As though you could use the figure of a fruit tree, you plant a fruit tree here, and you reap the fruit on that gone over there. Mm-hmm. Your experience is incomplete unless you reap the fruit of the causes you've set up here. But the dark things that you do are slept off in an intermediate zone. They might corresponding to the cosmic conception of purgatory. But it's use a different term, it's kama loka. And that doesn't go up. What is slept off there becomes a shell, a soulless entity. It's no longer the real entity. But it is kind of something like a tape recording of things that happened in the life. And it can be animated by mediums. And that's how mediums get. So it's said.
Mm-hmm. Well, could it be said that Devakan is a unawakened nirvana?
No, it's not a nirvana. And nirvana transcends not only this world, but Devakan.
Devakan
kind of a play world, isn't it?
It's a world, not a play, it's a world of reaping the effects of the causes as produced here during life.
Sure.
When you've exhausted them, then you're drawn back to incarnation.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about paying karma on this plane in the next life, for this life?
Oh, yes, you will. The karma determines the nature of your incarnation, circumstances, and so forth. Good, and that which is favorable and that which is difficult. I don't call any karma bad.
But you pay in Devakan and then you pay down here, huh?
Pay?
Uh-huh.
It's not paying.
Karma?
It's reaching, it's not paying.
Reaping karma.
It's reaping, yeah, reaping karma. No? The idea that karma is bad is a mistake. It's the law.
It can be difficult for me.
It's your equipment that is out of your past actions. And it can be magnificent equipment, and it also can be bad equipment, depending upon what you built.
I was just reading today in Hilarion's book about purgatory, and he explains it. Pretty much, the article is called Power of Light, and light diffuses, and if you are a selfless soul, concerned about the your fellow man, your race, and so forth, and pretty purely that way, and have not thoughts just for yourself, then the atoms will be diffused, will be, they will be diffused much faster by the light, whereas a very selfish person, I have an idea they are the ones who are mostly earthbound, and it would take them much slower. The light diffuses the solid mass much more slowly, so that these atoms when they are diffused, ultimately go back to their original nature, whatever it happens to be. So that he explains this as purgatory, that some of them withdraw out of this condition quite quickly and others take a long time. Because it's a matter of the light diffusing these atoms. And the quality of the individual is what has to do that. I mean, one is evidently less compact. And shut up. I can't say it, you'll have to read it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only part of the article. Complicated article. It has to do with vibration.
Who's the article, man?
Larry.
Old as my Larry.
Yeah, he speaks of darkness and evil. It's a matter of vibration. Where there is bright light, sunlight, for instance, you have high vibration there. It's just a natural range of vibration. And there's a chart. We've got a chart back in the hall. Where is it? Put out by Westinghouse. All the vibes, light rays, radio waves, gamma rays, alpha rays.
Well, last time I was here, you mentioned you didn't like the term vibration. You had another term you liked better. What was the other term? I've forgotten.
Psychosphere?
No, you mentioned you didn't particularly like the term vibration.
No, I don't find it explanatory.
You said you had another term at the time.
Vibes.
Other than that, what was your term? I've forgotten.
I don't recall it now.
Wasn't the psychosphere?
No, something other than that. You just reminded me when you were talking about vibrations, Gertrude.
Yeah.
I've been trying to think of that term that Yogi mentioned the last time I was here for the last several months, and I can't remember what it was.
But you know, for instance, that indigo and violet have higher vibrations than red.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an electromagnetic fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there.
Yeah, men like Tarthang Tolku wear red, the Tibetan thing seems to be red. I've always wondered about that. Red also.
Does he wear red?
Well, yeah, I saw him a couple weeks ago. He had his red thing on. I mean, that color thing. Well, it's also around these mm-hmm. pictures.
Right? Yes, he wears a red cap.
He gave us that.
He had a red traveling bag when he was here.
Who's that?
Tarthang Tolku Rinpoche. He brought us that over there.
Well, we were there last year. We looked him up. I thought he had on a black robe. What did he have on?
Well,
yeah, black would seem good.
He doesn't always wear red.
He's not always dressed up.
But,
well, it's a ceremonial color.
Oh, there's a funny story about that. A friend of ours wanted to get over to the ashram. He didn't have entree.
He lived in the area.
He seemed to know that I had entree. And he called up the ashram, spoke of my being here, you know, Gertrude, and made an arrangement to come over for him and his wife and Gertrude and myself.
They knew the way and wanted to go.
And
we didn't want to drive.
And, well, I didn't know. You didn't know the way. It's complex in there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Bertrand.
He wanted to meet him.
Or Bernard knew. Well, of course, you have to leave your shoes outside when you enter that place. I remarked to him, I said, you better be sure that you have unsanctified socks on. He read that off immediately, unholy. Well, we went in, Tarthon wasn't available immediately, and we were sitting in their outer room, and suggested we go to the garden. We went upstairs to the garden. Ordinarily, you'd think you'd go out and down, but here you go upstairs to the garden. And they have a garden up there, and a prayer wheel going. Say, there is a prayer, Tibetan prayer wheel, rotating in Berkeley, California.
With an electric motor.
Yeah. Electric motor, yes. Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It saves a lot of time.
We saw it. It's about...
It's a big one.
Big one, about this high.
It's a little house.
It's rotating around there.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Now you don't have to go to Tibet to see a prayer wheel. You can go to Berkeley, California and see one, if you can get in.
Well, nice to talk with
you. At first he didn't appear. Later he appeared up at the garden. And my feet were getting kind of cold. He said, you can put your shoes on. He said, that's special permission. And went down to their parlor that they had. We've had some nice seats and sofas there and so on. We had conversation. Boulard were there and Gertrude and I. The question came up, he wanted some information from some of his assistants, young women that were out in the entrance hall, or in the entrance area on at the desk. And he rings a bell, and in comes one and she drops to her knees. And he gives her instructions, she goes and carries them out. That happened a couple of times. Well, afterwards, when we left, Bernard says, I like the way he handles his women. And his wife said, that turned her off.
That's really nice.
Well, she missed it. If one of the men came in, he'd probably drop on their knees. They weren't dropping on their knees to a man. They were dropping on their knees to a Rinpoche.
Sure.
See, that makes a totally different matter out of it. But that was funny. Bernard admired it.
He was edging his wife at that point.
Yeah. Then he wrote in a letter, he suggested to me that I should get a bell on my desk. Well, I didn't have to. Gertrude put a bell there. I rang it, she came in and dropped on her knees.
What else could I do?
Of course I knew she was. She was acting, but it wasn't wholly acting because I could get that subtle force.
Uh-huh. Of course it wasn't acting. That, from the very beginning, it wasn't acting. Got that bell.
Haven't heard that bell in a long time.
I'll have to tell Bernard that.
Have him get one.
Yeah, it wouldn't work.
Maybe the way it is.
Yes, that's really the men that I know that would have said the same thing. It wouldn't work for them either. The ones who notice that it doesn't work for them. That's really funny.
I think I'll give Bernard a bell for Christmas.
Oh, you're getting into trouble with Nadine.
Is there a reason why there's so lesser women adepts than men? You know, that reminds me, thinking it's whole male-female question.
You know, there's only two or three in the case of the autobiography of Yogi. Same way with living with the Himalayan masters, only two or three. And in
Cosmic
Consciousness, Morris Buck speaks about it. It's the discipline is harder on feminine nature than it is on masculine. It's more difficult. There is quite a bit of austerity involved in the way. And it may be related to something that Robert Johnson pointed out. I never noticed it before, that the capacity to focus consciousness is masculine. The capacity for spreading consciousness is feminine. And what's required is focusing of consciousness.
Makes it harder. There's some other things too.
I can see it in Gertrude, the spreading. If I want to buy something in a store, I know what it is before, and I go in and get it and get out. But when she goes into the store, she knows everything that's in that store by the time she gets out, even if it's only a 10-cent purchase. And that's characteristic of women.
Well, women are drawn to material things too. They I think more so than men. They're the shoppers. They like to shop.
Enjoy it. I hate it. It bores me.
I think that's the usual.
Why is it that state, whether it's a man or a woman that's in it, isn't always maintained? I'm still dealing with this question. Once someone arrives in that state of realization, why is it that it isn't then continuous? Why do they are at times not in it? You told me that everyone, I guess, Buddha, Christ, weren't.
That's discussed in the Mahatma letters. You remember the section where he speaks of to put themselves into the luminous state takes an effort.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done when there's a reason for doing it.
Right.
And when you're engaged in ordinary activity, eating, dressing, and so forth, the ordinary affairs, you don't go into that state. Mm-hmm. It says it takes the figure of an athlete. He's not all the time pushing blood into his body as he would do if he's about to go into a race where he puts forth all the effort.
Mm-hmm.
That's just sheer waste to do it. There is a conservation of energy problem involved in this. Mm-hmm. You don't burn high energies when low energies can accomplish the result.
So in effect, these men are, yourself too, are in what amounts to the fallen state during these other times.
Listen, you can't speak of it as fallen anymore. That language is not valid here. It's on beam and off beam. I use that terminology. The figure is taken from the landing of an airplane by electronic means. When visibility is bad, it's on beam. I've taken over the figure. That when you are at times on beam, other times off beam. If a problem can be handled in the off beam state adequately, you don't turn on a higher energy. You handle every problem at the lowest level of energy sufficient to handle it. That's the law. Conservation of energy makes good sense.
Mm-hmm. The law.
It's not a case of slipping back into a fallen state. It's just simply a matter of applying good judgment. And furthermore, there's a certain tension, pitch of energy at the higher states. When you come out of them, when you've let yourself go into them fully and you come out of it, you know there's a subtle fatigue all through the body. The body's been strained. Don't let yourself go too far into an ananda. That can strain the body. You don't know it at the time. You know it afterward.
Burn it down.
And there's certain... Sir Auckland Geddes, Scottish doctor, in an address before graduating class at a medical school, told us several things, and one that are of very great interest, but one was where he and a fellow practitioner visited a patient who had been in a mystical state, and his every cell in his body seemed to be burned out. They had no, said they didn't know a thing about what had happened. Well, I can understand it. He just let himself go full into it. Physical body can't take it. Take a gentleman under and what you can handle.
And how about you? Are you getting pretty drained?
I don't know when I am, but I probably know it afterwards. Okay. When Kuthumi was going about his affairs, he was an official connected with the government. That's where he got paid and so forth. He wasn't functioning as an adept doing that. He rode on horseback. Didn't transport himself through space, which would take a high energy. There's common sense in these things.
Good. But once you've arrived in that state, you can always go back to it. You have this ability, as opposed to one who doesn't know that.
You can go on beam and you go off beam. Or you, when I'm working on a tape, I may start on the speculative level, which is off beam, and then go on beam spontaneously without hardly knowing it until afterwards. When you step over into transcriptive work. Now people that are sensitive listening to the tapes can tell the difference between when I'm on transcriptive, which is on beam, and when I'm speculative, off beam. And they tend to go into, sensitive persons tend to go into an induced state when I'm on beam, but never when I'm on speculative, off beam. Some problems, speculative thinking is enough. Lower energy.
It seems that your case is unique or of a certain sort, and that it seems that your experience in your case is unique and of a certain sort, that it involves the intellectual energy different than, say, it was in Christ or in the Buddha. It seems you
more like Shankara.
Yeah.
It's Jnana. And also in a Western body, which is not a duplication of Oriental experience precisely. Also pioneering it without a guru. I was told that was my job, to make a breakthrough here without a guru.
Well, if you can do it, then it can be done.
Well, of course, the implication was I'd done it before. Took an obscuration.
Mm-hmm. You hadn't done it in a Western body, though. You'd done it in the East. Yeah. Well, what makes it different in a Western body? What's the special
thing? Well, there's a different psychological difference. For the sake of here you want a library of material all of a sudden one evening.
You know, it's almost 9:30. I think you should get some rest.
Trying to pull our
I hate to say it.
What is the keynote of the West? That book. The book, Meeting of East and West. What's the name now, the author?
Is it Northrop?
Northrop, yes. Very good on this part. The key feature of Eastern man was the aesthetic component in things. Western man, the theoretical. They're supplementary, they're very different. And that difference applies to the yoga that would be proper for Western man. It's not the yogic forms that are proper for Eastern man, particularly Mongoloid Eastern man.
Get your taping all done?
Got Yeah, we got one more to go.
Oh, I raised the money. How much?
Well, that's just a donation.
Oh, gee. That's sweet of you.
Just a little humble one.
We thank you. Where'd you get the tapes?
I'm a drugstore downtown. By the way, Yogi, do you know of a fellow by the name of Rudyard?
Rudyard?
Yeah. Dane Rudyard?
I don't remember the first name. I knew a Rudyard. Rudyard. Is he still living?
Yeah, he's still living. He's about 80, I believe.
I thought he was older than myself.
I
wonder if it's the same man. I met him at the house in California.
He's not walking on my cat.
I thought he was older. Well, I'm 91, nearly 91.
Right. One of the people, a girl that worked for me, used to study under him, and she gave me a pamphlet of his, and he mentioned the Mahatma letters and the brothers in his pamphlet.
Mm-hmm.
He's written several books which I haven't read yet.
Well, wasn't he at the Temple of the People or
something? I met him there. I met a Rudyard there. Whether it's the same one or not, I don't know.
Dane Rudyard.
It could be.
He's an astrologer, isn't he?
Yeah, he's an astrologer.